You're listening to the I Love You Keep Going podcast with George Haas. For more information, please visit our website at www.metagroup.org. That's www.metagroup.org.
So welcome, everybody. This is I Love You Keep Going. It is February 29th, 2024 at 7:37 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the nature of suffering and how suffering doesn't seem to lead to any kind of insight or any kind of what we might call enlightenment. And then what it is actually that we need to begin to see in order for those processes to happen. And you look at the world, and the world is in terrible suffering all over the place, in the Middle East, in Gaza, in Israel, in the Ukraine. In our own country, as we approach the election, I have almost a sort of anticipatory horror of what the possibilities are that are coming. And I find that most of the time when I think about it and I think about my own ability to affect it, I feel rather hopeless about the whole thing. Hope, I know, is tricky. You don't want to hope too much. In some sense, create a kind of Pollyanna-ish positivity. On the other hand, each of us have the agents that we have in affecting these things. Mostly what we have is the capacity to talk about it in the social groups that we have. And it's very touchy these days to be able to talk about anything, very polarized. Over the course of the years of my life, I've watched this polarization happen, and I think that it corresponds to the gradual inequality that we've allowed to happen. When Iran fell, just going all the way back to the 70s, there was this buzz about what it is that would have to happen in order for that process to unfold, the collapsing of these stable or what are viewed as stable societies. And the RAND Corporation came up with this metric of the relationship between the bottom fifth and the top fifth. And they said that when the wealth of the top fifth exceeded 40 times the wealth of the bottom fifth, that the societies would become unstable and that the governments were likely to collapse. And that was at a time in this country where we weren't quite there yet. We were in the 30s of inequality, but we've now passed that up quite a bit. And then the rise of populists in the government. How does one confront that and then attend to the suffering experience that arises from that? In Buddhist thought, of course, we're looking at the nature of the human conditioning as one of suffering, but it isn't so much the experience of what's happening, but the willingness to cling to the particular outcome that you want. So when something happens that you enjoy, as it begins to pass, as all things are impermanent, we cling to it, wanting it to last longer. And as things arise that are unpleasant, we resist their arising. And that action of either resisting or clinging is the thing that causes suffering. I often talk about equanimity as this very lively, fully engaged activity where you keep your balance. The near enemy of that is detachment, where you don't actually feel anything or invest much in whatever's happening. Christian?
George, when you're saying suffering, are you using a very narrow kind of definition? Are you talking about kind of the second arrow in Buddhist terms, or are you talking about something more sort of the way that everyone uses the term suffering?
Well, I think in this particular context, in the describing the mechanism that we talk about quite a bit, that is the second arrow. We live in, this country, which is actually quite a privileged place to live, the US anyway, if you're in the US, and you have a certain level of security. Not everybody, of course, in our society has that level of security. I notice in that I stopped reading the New York Times, for instance, and the Los Angeles Times, and also the Washington Post, because the bias of the coverage became eventually unbearable. And I read the Guardian.
That's the only one I can do too.
And it's still, I find the coverage of the things that happen in the world to be very despairing. And at the same time, when I'm just working individually with people in the metagroup community, the different points of view that people hold, and in really trying to be caring and open to that whole mix that we have, it's very difficult to take a hard position on one thing or another without risking some front to some members of the group. How does one balance that? Trying to really accommodate everybody's point of view and at the same time taking some kind of position in relationship to the perception of what's happening. I don't, for instance, know what's happening. I know my experience with media, the reporting of it. It's so interesting to me that that we have such a capacity for cruelty in our human experience, that there seems to be no limit to the amount of cruelty, and that the experiencing of cruelty doesn't seem to provide any insight that would lead you to be less cruel to other people. And often, in fact, it creates the opposite effect, the extremes of response. There seems to be a collapse of mentalizing, as we would talk about it, a sense of the non-mentalizing mode of psychic equivalence, where you understand what you think is happening, and you think that your point of view on that is accurate enough that it is the experience that everybody is happening. It is the experience that is happening for everyone, so that you can take these positions. And yet, really, what we're all doing is responding to the stimuli that we select. I talk about this quite a bit, but we don't take a survey of what's happening. We take a survey of things that are our preference. And then from those moments, that gathering of what our preference is, from what's available in our sensing fields, we form a reality of this. I was talking to one of my students who is a neuroscience, and this big idea that there is both what's happening and what we make out of what's happening as this new concept in neuroscience, because they're being able to read the brain as it functions in that way. And then you reflect on the Buddhist philosophy of this, and 2,600 years ago, they were talking about the experience of sensing and then assigning meaning to it, essentially the same thing. Christian.
George, don't you, not to like fetishize suffering, but don't you think that like the cruelties that are done to us, like in a sense, they can maybe kind of turn us away from seeing those same kinds of things, but like in a traumatic way where we kind of disavow them or dissociate, but like when processed or when they're not overwhelming, don't you think that they can actually sensitize us to seeing those same kinds of cruelties in the world, and that gives an opportunity for compassion that maybe someone that hadn't been through that wouldn't have that same level of kind of that visceral sense of what's going on?
I do think that if you can integrate the experience, then the question, of course, is how does the world get to be the way that it is now? If everybody were able to do that, and so maybe the conclusion is that they're not able to do that. What I think I found this week, as things got so difficult in so many areas of the world, is the level of heartbreak that I'm experiencing is reaching the limit of what I can manage. And then I'm at that point of, in some ways, losing the sense of agency that I normally feel, and then just being overwhelmed by the sadness of everything. And how does one, I'm thankful that I haven't responded with a normal conditioned response of converting that overwhelming sadness into anger, which was the habit of the family that I grew up in. And it hasn't, that anger of blame and assigning responsibility hasn't also arisen. And to, as you say, which I quite like, opening that capacity for compassion to hold the experience of the suffering world, and to in some way process that, and then that threshold where you're overwhelmed by the suffering experience and begin to lose your equanimity, and then need to pull into a more sympathetic stance and bring yourself back into balance. Putin said in the paper today, or at least it was reported in the paper today, that if Europe engages on the side of Ukraine with troops, that we are at the threshold of nuclear war. I found to be quite a staggering thing to read in the paper. The UN on Monday said that the situation in Gaza was genocide now, whereas before they had said that it was inciting genocide, and before that they had said that it was ethnic cleansing because of the mass starvation that's happening there, which they said was the result of the Israeli military preventing humanitarian aid from entering Rafah. And these are, I have the overwhelming experience of just heartbreak, experiencing that. I grew up in a country that have succeeded in genocide. That's one of the things about being from the United States, is that our history of slavery and our history of the genocide of the indigenous population produced this vastly powerful country. When Trump was in office, the UN said that the camps that he set up and the taking of children and selling them through the private adoption agencies that took the children was a genocide. But it's in this country, there's so much that's not really responded to, that caused this outcry. But they didn't close the camps until he was out of office. Egypt is setting up refugee camps, but they're behind a wall. And camps in Syria are behind a wall, so that there's no capacity for the Palestinian people to immigrate out of the situation that they're in. So they're not really being helped by either side. So as a person, a single person, without much in the way of power, particularly to do anything about this, the balance is how to continue to operate in the world and to advocate and to express my experience of these things, and not completely lose equanimity and not have to disappear into some kind of idealizing state. And I imagine that if this is the experience that I'm having, everybody else is in the same boat, because it is the human experience of this kind of. In some sense, it's as a taxpayer, the money of that we pay is then making these kinds of things, in this country anyway, possible. And so we are all, in a way, complicit. How do you find equanimity with this? The Buddhist teaching, of course, would be to turn into it and to allow the sense of this, or at least as I experience the heartbreak, the sadness, to fully manifest and attempt to hold it in balance. We each have our own conditioning, of course, and so we assign meaning to this, and the powerlessness of my own childhood exacerbates the experience of the powerlessness that I feel in response to this. I'm talking about myself, because I don't want to assign blame or intention to other people. But it's, I find, overwhelmingly sad. So then when we talk about meditation strategies that then we can apply to this, the equanimity practices are really focusing on intensity. My favorite equanimity technique is the increasing, decreasing, same, gone technique, where you note the experience of the sensation as it is increasing, decreasing, it's staying the same, or it vanishes as all things are impermanent. Another one is low, medium, high. Or when you're working with emotion, simply doing the noting feeling states technique, where you're noting moment by moment the experience of emotions that are happening. We talk about four kinds of emotions to pay attention to. The present moment experience, the self-generated emotion, the somaticized emotion, and the empathetic emotional experience of other people, and how that cascading of emotional reaction can get so intense. You have the present moment experience, and if it exceeds the window of tolerance, then you have an emotional event that needs to be regulated, which we regulate through thinking mostly. The thinking process pulls us out of the experience of the moment into the thought process and generates in that thought process an emotion that can mask or displace the experience of the present moment. And we use the strategies that we learn in our family system. So if we have beneficial strategies, we tend to be more resilient. And if we use afflictive strategies, we tend to continue to overwhelm ourselves. If you use a lot of afflictive strategies, you probably have somaticized emotional centers that then become reactive. And all of them conflate when you don't have good clarity and create these intense emotional experiences. Then holding them each in spaciousness and separate so that you can have each of the three aspects of these experiences that make up the emotional content and balance them. And so then the experience of powerlessness arises. And I find that one to be particularly hard to be with. That desire of wishing to be able to affect some kind of change that would resolve the experience that people are having such hardship and horror, but having no real method to do much about it, that sense of difficulty. Without having to retreat from it, I think that that probably is the way that I have in the past, simply withdrawn from it. Not following what's happening, not voicing a response to it. It simply feels impossible to make any kind of impression. How then do you stay in the present moment when that's the experience? In the way that I grew up, one of the things that plagued me was panic attacks and not really recognizing when everything sort of clumped together, that my mind was accelerating a fearfulness by catastrophizing and then generating these very intense experiences. The thing about the emotional regulation system is that it's pretty automatic once you're trained. It just does it. So you find yourself caught up in these thought patterns that carry you into these extreme fearful states. And when I was, 20 years ago or so working with Shinzen, he said, just see if you can stay with the panic attack all the way through it and just note the intensity of it as increasing, decreasing, staying the same. And I noticed that when I finally was able to do that all the way up into that state, I was laying on my bed and noting the intensity of it, and I really felt that my whole body was flapping up and down on the bed from the physical sensations of the energy moving through the body. And I would open my eyes and I was just completely still, and then I would close my eyes and get caught up on these waves of emotional energy, and holding that whole experience in equanimity completely resolved that process for me, and I haven't really had anything like it since then. So that experience of powerlessness and that experience of heartbreak. And then there's the piece about what's coming. You look at that. Those situations, you look at the coming election. I find the motivations of the hard right to be impenetrable to my way of thinking about the world. I can't make sense of it. But it's frightening to me that makes sense to so many people. And then when I think about the points of view that I hold and the people that I know, I don't find those points of view particularly frightening, but I hear the hard right being equally frightened, or at least expressing the same kind of fearfulness about it. That also is hard for me to make sense of. An openness to the different points of view that people have seems easier than a hard rejection of them, as it appears to me. So I think that these are the reason I'm talking about this is because these are the edges of practice, at least as I experience it. I can go into a state and hold a very sacred view of everything and not be so bothered by all of this. But coming into the ordinary sense of reality, it's very hard to be in those experiences as they arise. So, in terms of today's practice, why don't we do some concentration practice to settle and then go into just that equanimity practice of noting intensity? It's a So it doesn't matter what the activations are, we're just really focusing on intensity. Is the experience of the present moment the same as it was before? Are you noticing increasing intensity or decreasing intensity? Has that particular pattern of sensory activations ended and then coming into another one? It's a kind of I'm listening to myself talk and listening to the quality of feeling, and it seems quite distressed. So I want to apologize for it not being lighter. World seems hard this week to me. So go ahead and settle into your meditation postures. All right, let go of the meditation. Comments or questions about the meditation? So we have a level one meditation and attachment level one in April. In May, we're going to do a 15-day residential retreat in Poland at the Sacred Mirror Center outside of Gdansk. We have a few spaces left for that. Take a look at that on the website. Then we're going to do a 4-day commuter retreat in Utrecht at the end of May into the beginning of June. We're going to do a meditation and addiction level 2 for the first time as a virtual experience. So that's a 12-week program that meets 3 times a week for an hour. So Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for an hour, going through that, the 4 modules of the meditation and addiction program. I think we're going to do a couple of level 1 meditation and addictions coming up to that. That should be in July. We'll begin a couple of level 2 meditation and attachments in July, in August and September. So we have a pretty full calendar coming up. Take a look at that. Most of it's up on the website. I offer this teaching freely, and I am very appreciative of your practice. We do have a donation link on the website. If you're resourced and can make a donation, that's appreciated. It helps support me and also the work that Meta Group is doing. Good to see you. We will see you soon.